All right, thanks for tuning in. You are listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today, my guest is Corey Hansen. He's the frontman of the LA-based rock band Wand, and he's also released a couple solo albums as Corey Hansen, the most recent being last year's album entitled Western Come, which is fucking great. You know, I knew Wand a bit. I had spun their album Gollum back in 2015 when it came out, and I liked it. But to be honest, I had kind of forgotten about them for a few years. And then last summer, I stumbled upon the song Housefly, which was off Western Come, Corey's solo album. It's the same song I just played at the top of the episode. And that opening riff was just totally irresistible to me. You know, I pretty much immediately loved it. And I went and listened to the entire album, and there wasn't a bad track on it. I've had it in rotation pretty much ever since. You know, it's honestly one of my favorite, you know, pure rock albums of the last couple of years. You know, there's a really strong kind of 70s classic rock influence on the whole thing, but it manages never to feel derivative or sort of like an empty nostalgia trip. So anyway, it was an honor to have Corey guest on Gaucho Amigos and hear his thoughts on Steely Dan. You know, he's a big fan of them. We also talked about Corey's own work and process and some other music stuff, too. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Corey Hansen. Enjoy.
When I was a kid, I was really into, like, fucking rock, like classic rock. And the Dan were a little too nuanced and, like, subtle, you know, or something. And I thought that it was like, you know, music for older folks, which is, you know, has proven true for me. Like my mid, you know, 20s was when I started listening, you know, to focusing on the Dan and stuff. And then, you know, it's kind of become more obsessive since then. But yeah, as a kid, I was like Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, you know, all the hard rock, Ozzy Osbourne, Black Sabbath, and then some metal and some punk, but mostly just classic rock, like dumb classic rock.
Yeah, same thing happened to me. I was more of a classic rock and like 90s rock kid, I guess. So cool. Did you play music as a kid? Like, were you already playing guitar?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was playing guitar. I mean, I was trying to play guitar at like 10. And there was always music around. My parents were split up, but my dad, you know, when I'd go over to my dad's house or drive in the car with him, he's a jazz pianist and jazz classical. And he's, you know, a really great player, but mostly, yeah, I guess listening to a lot of jazz in his car, a lot of like Mozart, Chopin, Beethoven, and then jazz, Miles Davis and Coltrane. And then on my mom's side, she was listening mostly to like country radio, like CMT, like Garth Brooks, and she was writing songs and playing in a country band when I was a kid.
Really? So both your parents were musicians. Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of music going on. But you know, for neither of those things I was very interested in. Like the top 40 country stuff I thought was annoying, and then I liked, like, you know, some of the Garth Brooks songs I liked. My mom was, you know, she was really into the Beatles. Both of my parents were really into the Beatles. And so she put on a Beatles record a few times. And I was like, Mom, this is bad. I don't like this. Sounds old. And then finally it clicked, you know, around puberty. When that stuff started to happen, I was like, oh, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, let's do this, you know.
Yeah.
Who is this guy playing guitar? Sir Eric Clapton. Okay, well, let's see what this guy's got going on. And then, that was when I started playing guitar, being, listening to Clapton and Hendrix and stuff.
Cool. Yeah. So in your teen years, you're already playing guitar. Did you play in bands? I mean, were you already
Oh
forming
yeah.
bands with your friends and stuff?
Yeah, I think the song writing songs happened very quickly after that, and playing in lots of different bands that would just exist for like two shows, and then it would be the same like four people, with a billion different bands. All of a sudden, we're listening to the Doors, and then we're like, okay, we got to be like the Doors, and then have a band for like a show, and then it falls apart. We all scream at each other, the same four people get back together. All right, like, let's make a band, that sounds like the Strokes or something. That was when that all that was happening too, like the Strokes and the White Stripes. And that just kept going. Then it would get weirder, like, okay, I just heard this guy, Captain Beefheart. Like, let's make a Beefheart style band. And then, we wouldn't even get to like a show with that one. It would just keep going.
So when did you consciously start listening to Steely Dan? When were you like, okay, these guys are like, when did you have that moment where you're like, okay, I'm gonna really listen to them like more seriously?
Well, I think that it kind of coincided with this moment when Wand was working on what record was it? Probably Plum. Sorry, fourth record. And we were just writing everything together and thinking a lot about group composition and like a live setting and stuff. And that was when, the conversations about like Asia started to pop up and like the way those songs are composed became, like a big influence, I guess. And they're all kind of like epic and have prog elements, but have pop elements and jazz elements, and they're very like good at involving all of those things and making those things work together in harmony. So that was probably when I started seriously focusing and listening to Steely Dan records. And I still didn't really like Asia. I thought it was still too just a little too pop for my taste. But then going back, and I think the first record that broke for me was Pretzel Logic for some reason. But I think it's probably because it's the most like 70s guitar forward of those early records. And it's just really, and the songs are very concise. It's like a Beatles record
It
in
is,
a
yeah.
sense. It's kind of like Help to me. I always think about it like that record for some reason. There's just a variety of sounds, that are all sort of like coming from all these different directions in time. And it feels like with Steely Dan, I mean, obviously, like a lot of the blues based, rock, all the blues based rock music of that time was concerned, at least like the big guys like Clapton and Keith and, like they were always thinking backwards. They were always thinking about like what, they were going back to Robert Johnson or whatever, and trying to like be a part of that tradition. Whereas Steely Dan kind of goes in all directions at once to me. It's like they're current, they're looking into the future, they're also like very much like acknowledging these traditions of the past, but kind of playing with that material in a interesting way, playing with time.
Yeah. And then on Pretzel Logic, the song is about time travel. So were you also a prog fan at all? I mean, I hear it a little bit in Wand, and I hear it in, you know, your solo stuff. I wouldn't classify it as progressive rock. Like, I don't think it necessarily like sounds like Genesis, but maybe it's in there.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, I'm a pretty big Genesis fan.
Yeah.
Big Yes fan.
Yes, I can
And
hear.
yeah, a lot of Steve Howe.
Yeah.
Mostly it's all the guitar influences. It's like, you know, Steve Howe's a really big one for me. He's very tasty. He's like incapable of being bad.
Yeah, and like
You
Driving
know?
Through Heaven, some of those licks are kind of like Steve Howe-esque, like
He just,
the melodies, I guess.
yeah, he has this really interesting, like, whatever the his choices, his phrasings and thing and stuff is like very like antithetical in some ways to like rock music. It feels like very precise and, you know, like acoustic in a sense or something. Not very electric feeling. Or maybe even just esoteric. It's like
Yeah.
a little bit less like blues based and more like Anglo, you know,
Yeah.
whatever, classical, and jazzier. It's jazzier than those guys. Yeah, and there's definitely like, I feel like Larry Carlton is kind of the other How or something, the American How for me or something, because he's doing that same thing on those Dan records. I mean, they have like no shortage of like incredible guitarists on their records, who all do things that are pretty inspiring. But his stuff, for some reason, like it really sets the tone for those later Dan records. And his like relationship to like virtuosity, I think, is like pretty inspiring to me. So I think I went I jumped, I think, from Pretzel Logic to Asia back again, and then was like, oh, Asia's, you know, like finally, like, you know, broke that open. And then, which it, yeah, that record, I think, I mean, what, there's like not a lot left to say about it that hasn't been said.
One of the challenges of this podcast.
Yeah. It's eerily perfect, you know, and it's kind of disturbing in a way, especially on vinyl, you know, listening to it. Like, I got a good pressing of it a couple years back, and I was just like, what the fuck, you know, like actually hearing how the sides are laid out and how the symmetry of it all, it makes it even, the mythology of it even scarier to me.
Do you consider it like a perfect album now?
I wouldn't. I mean, I think it's about as close to a perfect record as could possibly exist. I can't think of anything else that's really got that. I mean, in the late 70s, you know, they weren't the only ones that were trying to do this.
Right.
The Eagles, you know, famously, like, you know, had to do this kind of shit, and or you know, but there was an industry around producing rock hits that was like very focused on like the getting perfect takes, you know, perfect sound, perfect hi-fi like recording techniques, and capturing performances and hitting takes like 100 times, 200 times before you get something usable. Which is hard to imagine now. Like, I've never done more than 8 takes on a song. Cause it's like, what's the point? You know, I'm not searching for, aspiring for that level of perfection. And I don't imagine these things are going to be played on, you know, rock radio or whatever.
But you're not opposed to the like ethos of it necessarily.
Well, no, in the Dan context, I mean, for them, it's a little bit different because they're not really making singles once they get to Asia. It's like their songs are too long to be, they're like, you know, Asia's what, 7 minutes, 6.5 minutes? Deacon Blues is like 6.5 minutes. They're these epics, you know, that are, they have they're bigger and they have like a depth that pop songs just don't really have. I think in terms of chords and voicings and structure, they just do so many cool little Dan moves, you know. They're always like Fagan's always, you know, modulating around, you know, and doing things that in a pop context, you know, like Stevie Wonder is the only other person I can think of who's like really doing these intense chord modulations everywhere and anywhere, and is just like obsessed with it, you know. He's just like, na 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 na, and the Dan go like da 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 da, like up and down, and you know, kind of. But it's a little, it's a little more nerdy or like dorky, and their groove is kind of dorky too. It's like very. It's less like flowy and groovy. It's more like, I don't know. They have a very specific groove to me. But just arranging, like their arrangements, I think, are just really fucking good.
Yep.
I'm not really into the, I mean, I've read quite a bit about like the studio, like discipline that they have, and I think, like, in terms of like the way they record things and their general approach to recording, I think it's, I mean, obviously it sounds really incredible, but their approach to like getting takes and like, you know, the way that they treat musicians and stuff, I think is like kind of insane.
Yeah.
And torturous and like borders on like being like weird and but I do like that they are at least at the time in the 70s were a contemporary band that was mostly like utilizing recording techniques from the 1950s from jazz records and using those in like a pop context, you know, to make this like Dan sound, you know, which is like super hi-fi. And when it comes down to the engineering side of it, which I'm also like really interested in, and you know, like, and I always have a hand in engineering the records that I do. I don't like to do all the engineering because it's like way too much work. It's not really creative work, and it can be a drain. But like, you know, their approach is like very less is more. It's like the production is like really Spartan. They have like one plate. EMT played and like one echo, you know, like some digital echo or something. They don't really use like an overused compression, or they're very tasteful about EQs and so all these things are things that I've, you know, taken away from the Dan. And then also lyrically, you know, their lyrics are so fucking good. So that's definitely been another thing.
What's the difference between a Corey Hanson solo album and Wand in terms of like the, you know, songcraft process?
Well, they're very different now. The Wand stuff is like entirely collaborative at this point. The band is like fully equal parts. You know, we write everything together, and the solo stuff is really just me writing everything, composing everything. And so, yeah, there is like a very, like, I don't bring songs into Wand anymore.
Okay.
I haven't done that in probably 5 years. We just work collaboratively. Like, I'll, you know, mostly we work, we just improvise together. We just get together and we don't really, we'll talk about, like, you know, what movies we saw or something, but we just play music, you know, and we're all really into improvisation and none of us are very good at it. So it's kind of like an equal plane, you know, for us all to, because it's a lot easier for me to walk in, you know, and be like, I'm the songwriter. Here's the music, guys. And I don't think anybody wants that anymore. Because
yeah.
It, you know, it gives me like an edge over everybody else. And so we all just walk in and just meet wherever we're at, playing wise. And then that's, you know, basically how we've written all this music that nobody has even heard yet.
Oh wow. Because when did the last Wand record come out?
2019. So it's been a minute.
Yeah.
We're due.
Yeah, now you have this other outlet, you're doing your solo stuff, Pale Horse Rider, which I think came out in 2021. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And then Western Come, which came out last year. Yeah, after listening to both, you know, Pale Horse Rider sounds more like, I guess, within the genre of like singer-songwriter, whereas Western Come is more of a rock album, even though they're both solo. You know what I mean? Was that a conscious choice to do it differently the second time around?
At a certain point, it was. Yeah, I mean, I just sort of follow whatever I'm into, you know, whatever is resonating with me musically. I don't know, it's a weird thing. I'm trying now more to like plan things out. Okay, so like, or you're gonna have to do Western Come Two, that's coming up, so start writing that. And you know, Pale Horse Rider Two, that one's, you know, try to like follow thread, you know, those threads more. But usually when I'm done with a record, I'm like, let's go do this other thing. Like, I don't think about, the connective tissue between things very much, because I feel like, well, it's just all me making it, so that'll connect things enough. I just was playing a lot of guitar by myself, kind of for the first time since I was 14, 15, when I was learning how to play. And I would just sit in my garage and just play for hours and hours. And that's sort of, I got back in the habit of doing that, and was just like, you know, staring at an amp and, you know, playing riffs and writing. And then all these songs just sort of came out of that.
Was that from having maybe pandemic downtime or something, or just?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. That was like, you know, sad guy in his garage, you know, playing to himself because he can't play for anybody else. And then usually I'll do that for a while. I'll keep doing that thing where I'll, like, you know, every day go and write and write and write. And then if a pool of songs starts to emerge, then I'll start to, okay, I'll organize these and, you know, I'll get like a crew of like 20 songs together or more, and then record all those and then whittle it down to single LP, hopefully.
So you're kind of going for that 70s thing of making an album, right? There's a shape to it. There's a sequence. There's a pacing. There's a, I don't necessarily want to say a concept, but there's some sort of connective tissue there between the songs that you want everything to kind of fit under the same, you know, bubble or something.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I think the album, I just can't think of anything. I can't think of music in any other way than the album. I'm not like a songs guy, or I'm not a singles guy. I like songs, obviously, but yeah, it's all about the record, you know. If you can have a good song, but you can't have a good record, then it just, yeah, it doesn't. It's like I grew, you know, growing up in the 90s and the early 2000s, there was tons of records that just sucked, but they had one hit song, and it's like, wow, this song's great. And then all of a sudden the production value drops. It's like, what the hell happened? Like, these other songs fucking suck. You gotta have the record. You gotta be able to, you know, put 8 to 10 bangers in a row and then have people go, whoa.
Yeah, I actually feel like that was one of the things that the LP had over the CD. So with the CD, you could just kind of like fill it out with skits and, like, you know, whatever outtakes you had lying around. They could put like 16 songs on a record. You know, like the LP, I feel like bands were a little more choosier, or like thought more about kind of like what we were talking about, like making an album that has a, you know, specific aesthetic or shape to it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's real finite limitations, sonic limitations. And yeah, it's fucking awful, man. I hate it in some ways. Just dealing with it as like a material, the industry around it, you know, the industrial side of it. I hate it. You know, it's like producing vinyl is really difficult. Trying to get something to sound good over two sides is really fucking hard, and there's always compromise involved, even on records like Asia or whatever. It's like,
yeah. One thing that's kind of funny that you did is the song Western Come wasn't actually on the album, even though you called the album that, which reminds me of like, what's it, Led Zeppelin, Houses of the Holy? Like, it didn't make it onto the album, and then it came out on a later one. Is that an homage to that?
That? Of course. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always, I don't know. No one's more mystified about why I call my record Western Come than I am, but
Like Western come as an aesthetic or as an idea, like what is that? Do you want to explain, or is it more of just something that you're throwing out into the world and people will receive it how they receive it?
Well, I think it has something to do with what I was saying about Steely Dan being a band that, can exist in the present while looking at the future, but having all these roots, in the past. And that's kind of where I felt the Western Come record was coming from. And and then once it's completed that, it's like, okay, cool. Well, the record's done. And there's a lot of songwriting like that. I mean, there's a lot of people that put on, like the Dylan, fucking Rolling Thunder Halloween costume and sing some songs where they use some Dylan-isms or whatever, and that's enough to fool most regular ass people who like don't care about songwriting. But it doesn't really get by with me, and and I'm, into the idea of masks and stuff, but there has to be someone underneath the mask, saying some stuff. That's like Dylan's whole thing. He's the master of the mask.
Yep.
When I'm writing music, I always think in some way about the listener and what they're gonna. I think they need a guide, to get them through certain things, or I don't know. It's like you can. Like, I mess around with a lot of atonal stuff, and there is a lot of atonal texture, and there's passages, in Driving Through Heaven where it gets pretty heavy, and I'm doing a lot of screechy, fucked up stuff to the guitar. But I think about it as like, one aspect of this range, the spectrum of like what the guitar is capable of. And I just have no interest in like being scale guy or like
Yep.
doing like a blues pentatonic, being like the next Stevie Ray or something. That
Think there's any danger of that happening.
goes I've been listening to a lot of Stevie Ray Vaughan recently, but
Really?
yeah, maybe I'll make my big like Roadhouse Blues
Big
record.
blues record.
That'd be sick. I've always had this fantasy of having a Roadhouse band, but just perform it in like regular clubs and bring my own like chain link fence to put in front of us and not say anything about it, but just put it up there and see if people just start chucking bottles,
Like a performance art bit.
So where am I going with this? Oh yeah, there's range, but the vocals, I always feel like, I'm not gonna start, doing some like Yoko Ono screeching or something. That kind of range, I'm not that interested in. But yeah, having the vocals be a guide that's like, okay, here we're going through this like dark passage where there's a bunch of screeching guitars, and it's kind of like the Pink Floyd thing where it's, there's lots of darkness and like atonality and like things associate with like disharmony and chaos. People who are unfamiliar with, the history of avant-garde music and all that stuff, who are going to be like, what is this? This is scary sounding. Or,
Yeah, you do that a lot, this kind of push and pull. Like, there'll be like this really beautiful, almost country-esque sort of passage, and then you'll hear a little bit of feedback leading into some heavy guitar action. Is that, you know, I hear a little Radiohead in your stuff too.
Yeah, people compare a lot of publications write about my voice sounding like Tom York's or something, but I think it's a register thing. I mean, Radiohead was a huge influence when I was a kid. I mean, they're a band that has always, you know, like they've always included these like esoteric non-rock elements, you know, of things that, like, I feel like through them, that was how I got into like Can and Faust and Stockhausen, Penderecki, and, you know, like even like Miles Davis, like Electric Miles Davis and all that stuff. Was reading interviews with them. We're like, yeah, I'm listening to Bitches Brew. I'm like, cool, what the hell's Bitches Brew? And then you find a torrent for it on Napster. And
yeah, and you need those bands to be like gateways to other shit. You know? Like when Kid A came out, it's like, yeah, they'd be like I didn't know who the fuck Can was. Like, I had never heard of Can. And then like Tom York says in an interview, my biggest influence was Can and making this album. And you're like, all right, I got to check this out. And then just the whole krautrock thing opens up. But yeah.
Yeah, they definitely were opening up my little pubescent mind. And I think, you know, with this record, Western Come, like, I was thinking a lot about pubescent kids, like, not in a bad way, but like in a gross way, but in like a, okay, here's like a guitar record that's like what I would have want, you know, at that age, you know, with all of these new feelings, these big feelings and crazy stuff going on, like that I would want to be turned on to, and then would also kind of pull me in the direction of a lot of interesting things.
There's a lot of also kind of like driving or like road imagery on the album. Was it influenced by your experience on the road, like touring?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's like all the experience that I have. Being stuck in a van or on a plane or you know, traveling like in a direction.
Do you enjoy touring? Yeah.
For the most part, yes, I do. I think it suits my personality, you know, being like kind of like a shark brain, you know, like I gotta keep swimming. It doesn't work for a lot of people, and I've seen it start to wear people down, and you can get jaded and yeah, but for me, I've seen the way that the playing, you know, night by night has affected, you know, the whole way I play guitar, the whole way that I sing, and like the way that I improvise with other people. Luckily, like, I'm in bands where improvisation is like a big fact, because it's like the thing, you know, with Wand, it's like every night, you know, we're playing 30, 40 minutes of unscripted music. And so there is an opportunity to constantly be doing something that feels present, and like all of us, you know, doing this thing together and taking a leap in front of an audience, which is really rewarding as a player. But yeah, so yeah, I dig it. Yeah.
Cool. You said you might be into doing a blues record. Would you ever do something that goes even more in a jazzy direction? Like maybe putting horns, or I don't know, doing something like a Bitches Brew, like a more jazz rock fusion. I mean, I don't know, you know, how deep your jazz background is?
I mean, I have definitely thought about it. I would love to do that. I've just gotten into arranging for horns and it's really fun. So I wouldn't rule it out.
I think you'd be good at it. I think you have the right, like, musical mind for it.
It's thank you.
That's what I would personally like to see you do on your next album. I'm not saying, you know, you have to, but as a fan of your work.
Yeah, it's the jazz thing is tough. It's hard to commit to writing a jazz record and think about like writing original jazz songs. I mean, I have been like listening to a lot of like American Songbook songs and Gershwin and stuff like that, where it's like a mixture of, you know, jazz and pop and blues and some classical and or like Hollywood like musical stuff, and just those like songs everybody knows, or like listening to Sinatra records and the arrangements for those, and that's sort of been on my mind for sure. That whole catalog is like just unbelievably sad music, and it's so beautiful and so well arranged. I highly recommend getting into that stuff.
Yeah,
you know, I was listening the other day, I was listening to this Rat Pack record that I just found, and I was like, oh, I've never listened to a Rat Pack record. And it's like, you know, everybody's got their shtick. They're doing these like really corny songs, then all of a sudden, like all of Frank's songs are just these fucking depressing, like you can tell the rest of the Rat Pack is just like, dude, come on, like, don't you just do one of your swing songs? Like, why you gotta bum everybody out? But yeah, so listen to Only the Lonely. That record is probably the most the arrangements are really great. In the Wee Small Hours is also a really good one. The arrangements are really, it's all the Nelson Riddle arrangements. Like,
oh, yeah.
He and Frank kind of have this, he just arranges really well for Frank's voice. And the cool thing about Frank that I love so much is that he, except for one record, he always performed with an orchestra behind him live.
Right.
And that was like the full take. So every time you're listening, it's like that all was just happening.
Wow.
At the same time.
I realized that. Wow.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl and never ever think of counting.
I said this to myself. I didn't tell anybody else, because if I said it to like my other Dan friends, they'd be like, what, Third World Man? Who gives a shit about Third World Man? Like, that was just a fucking song that, you know, didn't make it on Asia, that they threw on last minute on Gaucho because the tapes got erased.
Yeah, the second arrangement tapes got lost, so they had to
bring
up one of the old Asia songs. Yeah.
Right. So, but I always felt like that song was so raw and, you know, just like more, like the emotional material of it is just stronger than like a lot of Dan songs.
It's true. Yeah.
So I've always like, and that solo is just like one of my favorite solos ever. It's just so fucking good.
And that's Larry.
That song.
Right? Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So is Larry your favorite of the Dan guitar guys, I guess?
I don't know. I think I love all of the Dan players. Like, I mean, I love Skunk and some of the Denny Diaz shit on Royal Scam is like, it's sort of hard to tell who's doing what because they cut so many people. But yeah, like the Green Ewing solo, I think is really great.
It's actually like it's still unclear on some out. Like on the Royal Scam, there's no actual track by track credits. So like people have been like piecing it together for like decades through like interviews and like I just interviewed for this podcast actually the drummer who played on he played on a couple tracks on Asia, a couple on Gaucho, and then a couple on Royal Scam. His name's Rick Murata. And I didn't know who played on Royal Scam on which tracks, but then he was like, yeah, that was me on Don't Take Me Alive. So it's like, okay, now I can file that away. But anyway, any last Steely Dan thoughts that something that you wanted to say or get off your chest?
I was just reading this interview in this book, this Derek Bailey book, with Steve Lacy. It's an interview where they're talking about jazz and how jazz, as a form, had already begun to like decay, by the late 1950s, and how, the movement of free jazz was really trying to liberate the form from being, idiomized by hard bop and like all that stuff that was happening, that was kind of commodifying like all the expressive like scales and modes and stuff into something that was like purely like kind of technical, and then later became very academic. And I think about that when I listen to a song like Deacon Blues, which is, like about this fella having a midlife crisis and, wanting to become like a saxophone player and, like essentially travel back in time. He thinks that, just by achieving that kind of technical skill, that it will add some kind of validation to like his existence and like make life worth living, even if all he wants to do is like kill himself. But just like thinking about that in relation to this, interview that I'm reading, where they're like, these people like really trying to push jazz, and talking about Ornette, and trying to move jazz into, this other place that's getting away from what it has become now, what it inevitably was going to become, because free jazz is ultimately like been sort of rejected by mainstream jazz and is something that will always be like subordinate to, the big academic world of jazz.